This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, poverty touches a majority of Americans at some point in their lifetimes, and the politics of fear dominates the election of 2012.
But first, a victory in the fight against President Obama's preventive detention law. A federal judge in the Southern District of New York last week declared unconstitutional legislation signed into law last New Year's Eve, allowing the indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens without charge or trial. The judge called the law overbroad. Marjorie Cohn, a professor at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California, explains the ruling.
That means that it also punishes lawful activity. For example, writing a book that might support goals that the Taliban supports that could be encompassed by this. And so she says it's unconstitutionally overbroad because it violates the First Amendment, and it also violates the Fifth Amendment's due process clause. So this is good news. Now, I don't think there's any doubt that the Obama administration will appeal her decision to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and eventually it might get to the Supreme Court. So it's not over yet. But after a very detailed hearing back in March, I believe, Judge Catherine Forrest made this ruling, struck down this part of the National Defense Authorization Act, it's Section 1021, and it was in response to a lawsuit by seven plaintiffs, including Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, Kai Wargala, who is a co-founder of Occupy London, a journalist named Alexa O'Brien, Daniel Ellsberg, Noam Chomsky, Brigitte Jonsdottir, who is a parliamentarian from Iceland who supported WikiLeaks' right to publish, and also Jennifer Tangerine Boland, who is a civil liberties advocate and independent journalist. So it is good news, but again, I expect it to be appealed.
The Obama administration said that the legislation was never intended to restrict First Amendment rights, but why did it fight so hard for it then?
Of course they're going to say that because the Obama administration wants to uphold that provision of the National Defense Authorization Act. But a judge, a federal court judge who heard testimony and questioned the Obama administration lawyers extensively, issued a ruling saying that, in fact, it did violate the First Amendment. And she tried to pin down the government lawyers, saying, for example, this is the judge, give me an example that distinguishes between direct and indirect support for terrorism. And the Obama lawyers couldn't give her one. And then Judge Forrest said, assume you're a U.S. citizen trying not to run afoul of this law. What does it mean to you? And the Obama lawyer said, I don't have any specific examples. And then she said, what does it mean to give material support or substantially support terrorist activity? And the Obama lawyers were unable to provide her any definition. So based upon this hearing back in March, Judge Forrest ruled that it was unconstitutional. And the seven plaintiffs were arguing that they, especially the journalists, but all of them really, that if they were to interview someone and write a story, and it turns out later that person was a member of an organization on the U.S. terrorism list, then the journalist could actually be in violation of this part of the National Defense Authorization Act just for writing a story, or somebody who published a book who agreed with some of the goals of the Taliban or criticized the United States policy could also be in violation of this act. So she said that given all of those things, that it's unconstitutionally overbroad. It violates the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment.
The judge said that not only would this law potentially harm these plaintiffs, but that it already had.
Right, and some of them have actually heard clicks on their telephones, assuming that their phone conversations are being tapped. One of the arguments of the Obama administration was that these plaintiffs didn't have standing. In other words, they couldn't prove that they had been harmed by this law. That was not a problem for the judge. She still ruled on their lawsuit. Now, it is possible, if and when the Obama administration appeals Judge Forrest's ruling to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that the Second Circuit Court of Appeals may decide that these plaintiffs don't have standing to object to the constitutionality of this law and throw out the case. It just remains to be seen.
Folks should understand that the entire law was not ruled unconstitutional. Could people be justifiably anxious that what has been struck down just creates a kind of protection for journalists and not the rest of us?
No, because if she finds that this section about indefinite detention is constitutionally overbroad, then it would apply to anyone.
There are already calls for demonstrations and such to demand that the president not appeal. Do you think it'll gain traction?
I don't think so. I think the president's going to appeal if he wants to appeal, regardless of whether, you know, many people urge him not to appeal. I've seen those as well. Obama is taking a very similar position to that taken by the Bush administration, which is pulling out all the stops, even violating civil liberties under the guise of this so-called war on terrorism, although Obama calls it a war on Al-Qaeda. Obama's policies along these lines go even further than the Bush administration. They include drone attacks in Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, killing many civilians, and even in areas where they think there's suspicious activity, but they don't have any specific names of people, they're still killing civilians with these drone attacks. And he is justifying that on the basis of protecting us against terrorism. Many people say that it's having just the opposite effect, that it's making us more vulnerable to terrorism, because when people in these countries see the United States drones killing their friends and then killing people who go to the funerals for the people who died, it makes them hate us even more.
The Bush administration, which did not have this law, claimed that there were rights inherent in the presidency to exercise the powers that this law would codify. The Obama administration previously said the same thing. So why do they need this law?
Well, it just codifies the practice that they've been already engaging in, which is indefinite detention of people, you know, in Guantanamo and other places with no charges, some of them perhaps for the rest of their lives. Now, keep in mind that indefinite detention without charges violates a treaty the United States has ratified. It's called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and it prohibits arbitrary detention. And when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. But the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, does not seem to feel bound by these treaties, and they're also taking the same position that the Bush administration is taking, which is that this treaty doesn't apply outside the United States. But the United Nations body that oversees this treaty has said, yes, it does. It applies in any area that's under the control of the United States as well.
Professor Marjorie Cohn is author of the book, United States of Torture.
Young black and brown people blew police whistles all over New York City on September 13th in opposition to Stop and Frisk. Carl Dix, who co-founded Stop and Frisk last year, along with Dr. Cornel West, led a march through Harlem. Dix says they've entered a new phase of the campaign.
There's a very important way in which it's an escalation, and that is that this was a way for the people who bear the brunt of the abuse of the criminal injustice system, the people who are racially profiled by the police, the people who are run into the system and have convictions built up on them and go in and out of prison, and then who face discrimination once they come out, it was a way for them to get involved in the resistance itself. Because when you're talking about people who have that kind of weight on them, they're not going to be the ones who are going to come to meetings and want to lobby elected officials and this and that. But they also aren't going to be the ones who take up a civil disobedience campaign like the one that Cornell and I initiated last fall. So we decided we needed a tool, a tactic that could involve them, one that gave them a way to resist, that did not open the door to further arrests and convictions. And that was the point to the whistles. The reports are still coming in, but our take is that they played that role. I say that with confidence because I was out in the neighborhoods in the days leading in, you know, getting out like 500 whistles out in Brownsville in Brooklyn, seeing the young people take them up. Every time the cops would drive by, dozens of youth would be blowing their whistles. Kids were like making it a part of their uniform, their style. You know, how they gonna show out in the street. I was in Jamaica, Queens. We got out 500 whistles there. And then yesterday in Harlem, on the day itself, there were dozens of us who gathered to be a part of the event. But then as we went along 125th Street, we got out hundreds of whistles, but we also met people who had gotten their whistles earlier and who knew that today was the day to blow them. And as they met us, pulled out their whistles and started blowing them with us. And then when we marched into the projects at 125th in Amsterdam, the Grant houses and the Manhattanville houses, we were met by dozens of people who had already gotten their whistles, were waiting to see if anything was going to happen that day. And when they saw that something did, they joined in, blew the whistles. Some of them marched with us. And very importantly, there were a group of five youth who took the lead and grabbed the whistles to run and get to those people who had not yet gotten their whistles. They lived in Grant homes, Grant houses. Grant houses has been having beef with Manhattanville, and the young people especially can't go from one project to the other, even though they're only two blocks apart, because of that beef. Well, yesterday, on the day to blow the whistles, these five youth had a debate among themselves as to whether they could go with us into what had been considered enemy turf. And their decision was that the littlest one shouldn't go with them. And they sent her back to Grant Houses. But the other four went with us to Manhattanville because they said, today, there ain't no beef. Today, we're all dealing with the way the cops come down on us. And they took the lead going through Manhattanville houses, getting whistles out and calling on people who are literally their neighbors, who previously they didn't feel like they could go among, to join them and join us in blowing the whistle. And it was really a beautiful day, 4 hours of oppressed people standing together in resistance to the way the police come down on them, looking out for each other, having each other's backs, not blaming each other or fighting against each other.
And this is the way for young people to represent, as they say.
Definitely, because, you know, I'm old enough to go back to the 1960s, and back then, you know, it's not like gangs and all that violence didn't exist, but when revolution had its day, people saw things a different way. The Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, other organizations got our young people looking at themselves and each other differently. They saw each other as being in the same boat together and standing up against the same enemy together. And that's what we need our youth to come to today. And that's why, you know, as a revolutionary communist, I take an approach of fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. That's how I'm going at this. And I feel like the front of mass incarceration, racial profiling, the torture-like conditions in prison are a very important front for that struggle, because that is literally a slow genocide targeting Black people. And we have to stop this slow genocide, beat it back, and reverse some of the attacks that have come down. And at the same time, through doing that, we can help people to lift their heads and see what the real problem is, the system of capitalism, and the real solution, revolution.
And we're addressing the larger aspect of the destruction that mass incarceration brings politically to our community, that there is no real movement without youth, and so many of our youth are politically demobilized because they cannot afford to confront the police.
Exactly. I mean, we saw that as far back as the murder of Sean Bell, when we went to the high school that he had graduated from to mobilize resistance. There was a lot of speaking bitterness, but then when we took to the streets, 300 students came with us, and over 90% of them were young women. And we were like, where are the brothers at? And the sisters said, hey, the brothers got paper on them. They don't feel they can make this move because, you know, on paper being they had convictions, they were on parole or probation, and being grabbed up another time would have meant possibly a long stretch in jail. So there's actually a conscious move to do this to the youth because, look, the folks that run this system know that they are enforcing unequal, brutal, and degrading conditions on black people and on Latinos in the inner city. They remember how black people responded in the 1960s and how the young people were on the forefront of that. And they don't want to have a repeat of that. So they want to get those young people and suppress them and trap them up in the criminal injustice system before they can make a move. In other words, they're waging a counterinsurgency before the insurgency breaks out and in an attempt to keep the insurgency from happening.
So they load down young black men with paper, but these guys can blow the whistle.
Exactly, and that's why we went at it this way. And look, like I said, the reports are still coming in. I've told you the details of Harlem, but people yesterday, just talking about New York City, were in the Bronx. They were up at City College blowing the whistle there. There were people in Brownsville in Brooklyn blowing the whistle. There were people down at Union Square blowing the whistle. And that's just New York City. Reports are also going to be coming in from Cleveland, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles at the very least. And we put the call out to people, no secrets. Write us about what you did. Send us pictures. Send us video. You know, because with these cell phones now, it's pretty easy to get a picture of something. And we had people wanting to line up and take pictures of themselves with some of the people who had come out. Because up in Harlem yesterday, the aunt and uncle of Oscar Grant, who had come into New York for the hearing and the cop who murdered Romarley Graham, they were there for that court hearing and decided to stay over to blow the whistle on stop and frisk. So they were there with us in Harlem. Pam Africa from the MOVE organization had come up. She was there with us in Harlem. Jazz Hayden was with us. Oh, and I can't forget my brother Benga Akinagbe, the actor who played Chris Partlow in The Wire, who has thrown into this effort, and he was out there with us. These reports are coming in, and we will compile them and send them out nationwide so that people can see the growing national movement that is building resistance to mass incarceration. And if anybody wants to check that out, get more information, or get involved, they can go to www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .org.
Carl Dix of Stop, Stop and Frisk in New York.
The 2012 presidential election is now in earnest. Yet both major parties are running on the politics of fear rather than economic substance. We spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, the veteran activists from Columbia, South Carolina.
Well, everything that the Democrats have done have been in response to the Republican Party's platform and their personalities and, of course, ideology. This ideology of the Southernization or the Confederate nature, Southern strategy nature of Republican politics. Republican politics have always, well, at least since the Dixiecrats abandoned the Democratic Party to join the Republican Party, everything that they've done has been based on race. So when you look back at this primary season, from Gingrich and his food stamps comment to Santorum talking about black folk want something for nothing or want somebody else's money, to Romney making the speech at the NAACP convention only to go back and regurgitate Santorum's line. Their campaign has been about race. And then, of course, when they attack Obama as being incompetent or being foreign, that is about race. And it leads black people in America to rally around him, because any attack on Obama's competency based on his race is an attack on racial competency, the racial competency of us all to participate in the process to lead this nation, to lead anything, unless it's leading as defined by the Republican Party and their cockeyed notions of entrepreneurship and capitalism. So in responding to race, the Democrats have responded with a platform that aims at reaching out to white voters, which is what racist campaigns do. The idea of bringing in Bill Clinton is about reaching out to white working class voters. That's, I guess, better than Obama doing what he usually does, and that's playing kick-a-nigger politics like the rest of them, where he goes out and talks about black folk ought to be cleaning up their neighborhoods or ought to be not feeding the children Popeye chicken and all the other slurs that he's made against the black community when he's felt a need to do so. So a lot of the campaigns are pivoting on race. The Republicans are running welfare ads in some of the swing states, and hopefully we'll all get through this. But the other thing that it does for people who are concerned about the working class and about black folk who are trying to climb into that middle class that Obama talks about, expanding the economy from the middle out without any recognition that there are people on the bottom that have to get up into that class. It's all about making like poor people either don't exist, or if they are poor, they are poor because they want to be poor. And if the Democrats talk about poverty, talk about welfare, then they think they see ground. In the past, the Democrats have appeared to be weak on crime. So what happens? Bill Clinton comes and he leaves office and he puts 100,000 more black men in prison than what went to jail during the Reagan administration. They talk about Democrats being weak on defense, and what does Obama do? He doubled down on Afghanistan and expands drone warfare around the globe. These are all things that Democrats do in response to the Republicans. It keeps moving our politics in this country further and further to the right. Obama mentioned FDR in passing, but Ronald Reagan's name was mentioned far more at that convention, at the Democrats' convention, than FDR. And then, you know, when you look at the people who service that convention, I talked to a woman, one of the vendors who was at one of the kitchens, one of the restaurants in Time Warner Center. She got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to come to work every day that convention went on. She worked till midnight and beyond. She went home, got a few hours rest, and then had to come back to work. Or all those workers that were supposed to work at the Bank of America, which they tried to rename the Panther Stadium for the purposes of optics while the convention went on. But all those workers who generally worked the games at the Bank of America Stadium, who were working that convention, who when they called it off, those people were left without a paycheck for that week, either working a game that didn't occur or a convention event that didn't occur. And these are the people, as Jesse Jackson once said, who get up every morning and catch the early bus. They're the working poor. They are the people that change the bedclothes on hospital beds that they can't sleep in. They are the damned and the despised poor that nobody wants to talk about these days, even as the wealth gap in our country between poor, middle, and rich increases, as the poverty rate continues to grow, although it's been stagnant for the last year, but it keeps growing and growing and growing. And when you talk about things like Social Security reform, and you raise the specter of ramming Simpson Bowles through. No one talks about this idea that that commission wants to raise the retirement age to 69, which is the average age that most black men die in America. So unbeknownst to them, the person they think is the champion of their cause really wants them to pay into a system and die. And the other irony of that system is they pay into that system and die, and the money that comes out of that system goes to pay for more and more wars and more military bases across the world. Where's the benefit for them in that? The other thing about that convention, I guess it was sort of a jobs program that Michelle Obama was offering, was to have Michelle Obama introduced by a woman who was the son of three or four kids in the Army, and she couldn't wait to get the other one to join the military, as though joining the military and going off and killing some other parents' kids is the only jobs program that they can offer to poor people, a poor person's draft, as some call it, and softening the face of militarism and empire around the world. That was off-putting, but then again, no one's going to make a negative analysis of any speech that Michelle Obama makes or look at what it is that she's promoting in that speech.
Everybody's unemployment went down at least a little bit last month, except for black men's unemployment. But I guess that's not an issue.
It hasn't been an issue for Obama taking on any of the issues of poor black and brown people. As I said, he passed the DREAM Act. But what does that do for the parents of those kids who are covered under the DREAM Act? Or what does it do for the people who were deported during the Obama administration? He stood up against Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that was the right thing to do. But Obama hasn't stood up against the banks for homeowners, in particular black and brown homeowners who were the victims of subprime lending from some of the banks that sponsored much of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's conventions, the Bank of America or the Wells Fargo's. Many people, when Obama was running as a candidate, demanded a moratorium, demanded that candidates support a moratorium, as even Hillary Clinton and John Edwards did. Obama didn't do that. He supported the TARP money going to the bankers that sat in the banks after the feds gave it up to them or was used to pay off the bonuses of the very banksters who had almost crashed the system. And so now you see the next move, if Obama's reelected, will be an attack on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid that people are not prepared for.
Obama mentioned the $4 trillion in cuts figure. I guess that means that that is now the holy writ of the Democratic Party. The $4 trillion figure was about the same figure that the Republicans were bandying about last year. The difference being that Obama was calling for some modest increases in taxes, and the Republicans refused to contemplate that. But what is the difference to people who fall under the cuts of those $4 trillion if they lose their survival programs, whether a rich person's taxes increase or not?
Look, any numbers in regards to aid to poor and working class, and let's call them working class people, from either party is not on the table. There may be some differences between Obama and Romney as it relates to economic policy. It would be very, very difficult to see it. You know that as well as I do. His victory, Obamacare, was nothing more than a Heritage Foundation creation that Bob Dole and many other Republican legislators have supported in the past. So it's certainly not as radical or systems/life-changing as single payer would have been. So, you know, we can't look for our help or for any kind of salvation from any elected officials. What has to happen in the future is that we have to organize something on the local level that affects politicians on the local level that translates upwards instead of waiting for some type of trickle-down salvation or some sort of democratic version of trickle-down economics.
You've run lots of campaigns, and I trust that you know how to gauge the sensibilities of voters, at least the ones around you that you come in contact with. Are the Democrats now running on this fear of Republicans campaign? Can they be expected to get an enthusiastic kind of response from the base, especially from black folks?
Well, obviously, black people, and if you believe the last poll, where they showed 95-96% support for Obama and 0% for Mitt Romney, you can pretty much expect black voters to vote for Obama. Whether or not they go out in the record numbers that they did in 2008, that remains to be seen, especially when we're talking about shrinking democracy, where pundits and pollsters talk about swing states, where a lot of the campaigns focus their time and money, and they write off other states. Surely, people will go out and vote for Obama for whatever symbolic, optical reasons. A lot of people just like this idea that you have a black family living in the White House, and they believe that that is a victory in and of itself. But, you know, we didn't elect our way into any problems, and we're certainly not going to elect our way out of it. And it's time for the left, and especially the black left. The black left has a responsibility, A, to tell the truth, to educate the people, and to help people organize where they can.
You know, George Bush got, for a Republican, a respectable black vote, that is, for a post-Eisenhower Republican. And yet Romney doesn't show up at all. Why is that?
Because the Romney campaign is running a blatantly racist campaign. They're going after white voters. They're saying, they're using all the code words, welfare, doesn't want to work, socialist, capitalist. Their campaign is just patently racist, whereupon the Bushes, from the father to the son, were a little bit more sophisticated in how they approach race, and they spent money in the black communities, and they used the faith-based initiatives to reach out to at least black preachers, kind of almost in the same way that Richard Nixon, who many people forget, was one of the prime architects of affirmative action, the affirmative action programs that we see now. Richard Nixon didn't necessarily want the black folk organizing and protesting against him, so they had this policy where they wanted to create a black millionaire day, thinking that that would be one of the ways to kind of quash black opposition to Republican politics. This new breed of Republicans play from this totally racist Southern Confederate playbook, this Tea Party playbook that says that anything that the government does to mitigate past discrimination takes away something from them and takes away from their hard-earned work. And then there are other folk who believe, when they talk about socialism, they believe that Obama wants to keep them from being millionaires, like as though everybody is just a frustrated millionaire. They actually believe that the Democratic Party is about socialism. And, you know, I can respect that more than I can respect just this idea of using race fear and ignorance and perpetuating the lies. I mean, the difficulty in challenging the sameness of the policies between the parties and the politicians is this idea of the racist, social, political attack that the Republicans continue to make.
Activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, speaking from Columbia, South Carolina.
Recently released U.S. Census Bureau figures show that poverty continues to hover only slightly below 1965 levels. But it's worse than that, according to Stephen Pimpare, an associate professor at Columbia University and author of A People's History of Poverty in America. Professor Pimpare says the official numbers fail to show the true scope of poverty, which actually touches a majority of Americans at some point in their lives.
The way that the Census Bureau gathers these data is they do a very, very, very large and very, very sophisticated survey that usually takes place in March of the previous year, right? So the numbers for 2011 took place this past March in 2012. What those numbers then tell us is that 15% of Americans were living in poverty when they conducted that survey. March of 2012. However, what we know from other research is that Americans move in and out of poverty, and it's actually a fairly uncommon event for people to be poor for very long periods of time. Poverty is what's often called epiphenomenal. It comes and goes. So if we step back and look at, say, a longer period of time, look at, say, 2008 to 2009, and ask how many people were poor at all for 2 months or more between 2008 and 2009, it's not 15%, it's 28% of people who had an experience with poverty a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months. If we step back even further and look at a three-year period and ask the same question, right, how many people had an experience of poverty for 2 months or more, that number is not the 15%, that's the official rate, not the 28%, that's the two-year rate, it's 46%. 46% of Americans from 2004 to 2007, let's take those 3 years before the recession, 46% of Americans experienced poverty. This is not a problem of the minority, which is the way I think we tend to talk about it and think about it, right? That it's some sort of other, that's other people's problems, that's a different group, that's not me. It's very nearly a majority of Americans who are going to experience poverty, thankfully most of them not for long periods of time, but they will experience poverty, and once they've had a spell of poverty, they're even more likely to have another one somewhere down the road.
This says something about the United States and its vaunted mobility, in that we have something approaching or at a majority of people who experience downward mobility.
We have always overstated mobility in America, right? Those stories we have always told to ourselves and to the world about the United States being the land of opportunity, that we've got greater levels of upward mobility, et cetera, with the possible exception of a brief period of time in the late 19th century, that's never been true. And in fact, you know, large parts of Western Europe and the Nordic countries have much better rates of mobility than we do here in the United States. Not only do we not have as much mobility as I think that people tend to think we do, but those rates have been declining for more than 30 years now, since the 1970s. So if you look at sort of the people who are born into the bottom, the poorest 20% of the population, fewer of them are moving up to the middle class and above. And on the flip side, if you look at people born into the top 20%, fewer of them over the course of their lives are moving down into the middle class or below. So we're getting, in fact, what's a more rigid class structure, ironically enough, than Great Britain, right? A country that still has a monarchy, for heaven's sake.
Well, isn't that something? In the United States, poverty is the word that shall not be spoken. You hardly heard that word at either the Republican or Democratic conventions, and yet it's something that touches, not just indirectly, but directly, a majority of people in their lifetives.
Well, in fact, if I talked about how many people are poor over a three-year period, we can actually, in fact, step back even further than that, thanks to work that Mark Rank, who's at Washington U in St. Louis, has done. And if we look, in fact, over people's entire adult lives from age 20 to 75, 59% of all Americans are poor for a total of a year or more over the course of their lives. Now, again, for most people, that's not a consecutive year, 2 months here, 3 months there, 6 months there. Almost 60%, almost two-thirds of all Americans are going to be poor at least once and for a total of a year or more over the course of their lives. Again, I mean, in a lot of ways, we've really misapprehended the problem, and we've done this for years and years and years by focusing on that grim as it is, that 15% census number that comes out every year. What I would suggest is that I think too often, both on the left and right, when we hear 46 million Americans living in poverty, that the people who are poor are poorer, that it's much worse in certain neighborhoods, that it's much worse among certain population groups, and it's been bad for decades, and it's getting worse, I think a lot of people, again, both left and right, sort of throw up their hands, resort to scripture and say, well, the poor you shall always have with you, and there's nothing that we can do about that. However, I think it's useful to keep in mind what happens around the rest of the world. If we look at other rich democracies, right, other places that have essentially democratic political systems and have large, complicated economies integrated with the world economy like us, every single one of them does a better job at reducing poverty than we do. Every single one of them does a better job at reducing child poverty than we do. Some of them better than others, and they all do it in very different kinds of ways, but they all have figured out a way to do this. So I think to sort of throw our hands up and say, well, the problem is too hard, I think that's wrong. I think it's not a policy problem. It's not that we don't know how to reduce poverty. It's that those with the political power to do that, for whatever reasons, have no interest in doing so. And that, I think, is where we need to focus our attention. How do we collectively use the power that we have to push on that political system to be more responsive to the needs of the majority?
Well, could it also be that poverty in the United States is at least perceptually racialized, and there are large bodies of people who think that those who are poor have brought it upon themselves, or that it's built into their culture?
Absolutely, and it's worse than that, of course, because there is one of our two main political parties who, in fact, uses that racialization of poverty and social assistance programs as a way to mobilize voters. This is, you know, sort of the Southern strategy from the 1960s right up through what we tend to refer to today as dog whistles, right, especially now that we have an African-American president. The references to Obama as a food stamp president are not accidental. Right, those are drawing on decades' worth of effort to associate support programs for low-income people with African-Americans, mostly not borne out by the data, but you know, this is never about data, right? Decades' worth of efforts to associate particular population groups with these programs in order to mobilize middle-class white voters, right? This is sort of what Republicans have been doing for decades, looking at the demographics, trying to figure out where their base is going to come from, and coming to the conclusion, both through welfare policies and later in the 60s and 70s through criminal justice policies, coming to the conclusion that if we can identify an enemy, if we can explain why the white middle class is suffering too and is living in financially insecure households, if we can find an enemy for them, they will be drawn together and drawn toward us. We've got someone to blame. They're who the problem is, right? Those people in the cities, and that those in America is almost always African-Americans, and that's, to state the obvious, an extraordinarily long history we are still trying to overcome and make sense of.
Stephen Pimpare, author of A People's History of Poverty in America.
The Obama administration's housing policy has been to allow the banks to deal with the crisis as they see fit. Protesters associated with the Occupy Wall Street movement have for months been demanding that President Obama fire Edward DeMarco, head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, for failing to save underwater homeowners. But Glenn Ford says DeMarco is only carrying out the administration's wishes.
Protesters associated with the Occupy Wall Street movement charge the housing agencies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac with refusing to lower the mortgage principals on 15 million homeowners who are underwater, their houses worth less than what they owe. The problem, say these activists, is Edward DeMarco, acting director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The protesters, including Occupy Our Homes and Right to the City, have been careful to frame DeMarco as the problem. They've been calling for his head for many months. But DeMarco is just a cog in a very big wheel, a career civil servant who is faithfully carrying out his president's housing policies. DeMarco deserves to be demonized, but President Obama is the real villain here. Although he oversaw the biggest bank bailout in U.S. history, Barack Obama has long rejected any bailout of homeowners. Before the financial meltdown back in early 2008, candidate Obama opposed any form of moratorium on home foreclosures, putting him to the right of candidate John Edwards, who wanted a mandatory halt to foreclosures, and Hillary Clinton, who favored a voluntary moratorium.
In the first 2 years of his presidency, it was Obama, not the minority Republicans, who stood in the way of a bailout for homeowners, even as his administration and the Federal Reserve funneled trillions of dollars to Wall Street. As reported in the New York Times last month, the Obama administration refused to spend hundreds of billions allocated by Congress for housing relief until the program expired in 2010. The money was just sitting there, unspent. No Republicans were blocking it, while 5 million families lost their homes. According to the Times story, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner told Obama that he would not spend money on housing even if another $100 billion was available. Geithner and Obama flaunted the specific will of Congress, refusing to come to the aid of those populations and regions most affected by the housing collapse. Almost $6.7 billion set aside for the hardest hit program sat idle in Treasury Department accounts for 2 years because Geithner managed to spend only 3% of the money. This was no accident or oversight, but deliberate and consistent Obama administration policy to leave the housing crisis for the banks to deal with in ways they saw fit. Federal intervention might upset the bank's careful calibrations of how many families to dispossess, how many houses to put back on the market, and when, in order to keep the bank's books looking healthy. It was never in the cards that the Obama team would support widespread reductions in mortgage principals. Their job, as they saw it, was to protect the bankers' bottom lines and to hell with the millions of Americans, disproportionately black and brown, who got thrown into the street. Yet many activists, waving the Occupy Wall Street banner, insist that a bureaucrat named Edward DeMarco is the devil behind all of this suffering. Even in protest, they can't bring themselves to tell the whole truth, the truth that the people most need to know, that President Obama has callously allowed millions to be made homeless in his steadfast service to Wall Street.
Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, is about to launch a new economic stimulus program, not for you and me, but for the banks. Bernanke wants to make virtually free money available to private banks for the indefinite future. We spoke with Dr. Tony Montera, professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. He says propping up the banks won't solve capitalism's problems.
I think this term is a way to get out of the whole question of resolving the political contradictions that are preventing the government from really doing what needs to be done. And that means another stimulus package, but larger than the $800 billion that the first 2009 stimulus brought about.
You're talking about a stimulus that puts money in people's pockets rather than corporations getting credit.
Exactly. What Bernanke is doing is going to generate pushback from other nations. Because in a lot of ways, this is a form of devaluing the dollar. And in devaluing the dollar, you revalue other currencies like the Chinese renminbi and the euro upwards. And so it's a kind of a trade war type of policy as well. It makes U.S. products cheaper in other countries and other countries products more expensive here, which could be considered a form of economic warfare against America's trading partners.
And what form might that pushback from other countries take?
I think that, for example, we already see a certain pushback in the fact that a number of Asian countries are now using the Chinese renminbi as a trading currency or a reserve currency. The growing indication that a bank of the BRIC countries, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they will set up their own bank and they will trade with one another in the currencies of their countries rather than the dollar. I think the more that Bernanke does this, the more we're going to see the dollar being pushed out of international trade, and more trade between nations will be in other currencies other than the dollar.
Well, what is the U.S. empire without the supremacy of the dollar?
The weakening of the dollar is a indication of the weakening of the American empire. And the fact that as the dollar is weakened and other countries choose new currencies through which to trade and invest, that in fact we might be looking at the decline and ultimate collapse of the U.S. empire.
If the United States doesn't have soft power, that is, the power of some kind of moral example, and it clearly does not anymore, if it ever did, and if it doesn't have the power of the dollar as the supreme reserve currency, then all it's got is the guns. Isn't that right?
That's absolutely right, which is, of course, a very dangerous situation, because the American empire is losing, is being forced to retreat and contract, and it seems that its last resort is to use the military to push back against this inevitable retreat that it has to make.
It seems that in desperation, or maybe there's another interpretation, the United States has now created even firmer bonds with Salafis and jihadists and others that it thinks it can engage against what it perceives as its enemies.
And, you know, which are essentially no longer non-state actors. That's a fraud and a farce. The enemies that the U.S. military is targeting are states, not non-state actors. States such as Syria, states such as Libya under Gaddafi, and Iran and China. So they're using these non-state players. In fact, what they're calling Al-Qaeda might be an invention and creation and instrument of Western intelligence agencies rather than a so-called jihadist or Islamist non-state terrorist movement.
So what you're describing is exactly the opposite of the rationale for the war on terror, which was that
exactly.
The United States is engaged in this long, long war against non-state actors. But what you're saying is, no, the United States is engaged in a struggle to undermine actual states, and it is the one that is using the non-state actors, the jihadis, the Salafists, and others, in its war.
Exactly. That's my point. And I would say, you know, you have to look at American intelligence, British intelligence, to a certain extent, French intelligence, and in a large way, Israeli intelligence.
The U.S. and European campaign against Syria doesn't seem to be adhering to the timetable that Washington expected.
Exactly. Glenn, I think back to the U.N. security vote where Russia and China abstained, and had they vetoed that no-fly zone resolution and everything that followed, we would have had a different outcome in Libya. The fact of the matter is, it took the abstention or what I thought was a form of collaboration with the West and with NATO to bring Gaddafi down. And the fact that they are now going in the opposite direction and vetoing these no-fly zone and other kind of resolutions means that it creates space for the Syrian government to mount its forces to defend itself against this external aggression. And it seems to me that the Syrians will win. I think it will go beyond the stalemate that we're looking at now. I think the Syrian government can defeat these external forces.
And just recently, the non-aligned movement unanimously backed Iran's right to develop its nuclear potential.
Which was another defeat in the diplomatic field for the West, and in particular for the United States.
The United States says that Iran has been isolated from the world. Obviously, that's not true. The non-aligned movement makes up a great big portion of the world.
Well, two-thirds of the General Assembly were in Tehran, It was a real political and diplomatic defeat for the United States and the West, and it proved that Iran is not isolated, but in fact it is the United States, Israel, and the NATO powers that are isolated. You know, this is very important because we're seeing gradually, and not without ambiguity and contradiction, we're seeing the planet being transformed before our very eyes. We have moved into the 21st century with a new political reality. It is my belief that the forces opposing American empire are stronger and more united now than they were during the Cold War period. That is, when we had the Soviet Union and the socialist camp. Now, without the socialist camp as it existed in the 20th century, we're seeing a more united, and I would say more resolute, front against U.S. hegemony and U.S. empire.
And that's it for this week's Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And please go to our website and check out our plans for October 12th, where Dr. Cornel West and other friends of Black Agenda Report will help us to raise funds at New York City's historic Riverside Church.
We'll also be unveiling the first episode of our new program, Black Agenda Television. So go to blackagendareport.com to see how you can join us on October 12th. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation. We'll